Today in Midday's second hour, three segments, three subjects. Up front, Maryland politics. WYPR's Karen Hosla joins us to discuss the steady diet of attack ads unleashed by candidates for governor. And WYPR reporter Chris Connolly follows up on his reports about Maryland campaign finance laws. Next, Midday on Health contributor Dr. John Smarr surveys the latest news on the West African Ebola epidemic and the flu-like enterovirus D68, a case of which was confirmed in Maryland for the first time this week. Plus, a fan's farewell to football, a conversation with author Steve Almond about why, after 40 years, he can no longer watch the game he still loves. That's Midday's second hour after the news. And welcome back to Midday, everyone. Our second hour, Dan Roderick's here. Thanks again for joining us. In the hour ahead, we've got three things to offer you, three subjects, three segments. Midday health contributor Dr. John Smarr will be joining us to talk about the Ebola epidemic coming out of West Africa and the arrival of a rare flu-like virus here in Maryland. So a health segment for you in this hour. Later on, Against Football, a longtime fan of the sport, says it's time for Americans to give up the game. Steve Almond, who's been a watcher and follower of professional and college football for 40 years, says he can't do it anymore. He'll tell us why later in this hour of the show. Up front, at the top of the show, we speak to WYPR's Karen Hosler about the gubernatorial campaign here in Maryland. And joining me in the studio to talk also with Karen is Chris Connolly of the WYPR news staff. Nice to have you with us, Chris.
Happy to be here.
And Karen is joining us by phone. Hi, Karen.
Hi there.
Larry Hogan, let's step right in here. The Republican gubernatorial candidate, Larry Hogan, had a press conference this morning. You listened in. What did he have to say today?
Well, let's just say that the increasingly nasty campaign between Lieutenant Governor Brown and Republican Larry Hogan took another dark turn today when Hogan charged that there is has been essentially a corrupt relationship between contractors who contributed to the Democratic Governors Association, particularly when Governor O'Malley was chairman, and who at the same time then got contracts from the state of Maryland to help run what turned out to be the failed Maryland Health Exchange. He is calling upon federal and state prosecutors to investigate this, to find out if there have in fact been laws been broken.
Interesting. As you said, Martin O'Malley was chairman of the DGA, the Democratic Governors Association. So Larry Hogan is running against Anthony Brown. So clarify, what's the connection Larry Hogan is making to Anthony Brown?
It's so interesting. Some days you want to say they want to say that Anthony Brown, who was technically in charge of setting up the health exchange program in Maryland, you know, when it looks like the job was done terribly, then it was all Brown's fault. You know, when things are going well, then Brown was nothing but a figurehead. So today, the idea is that what really aroused Hogan's suspicions, he said, he always thought there was something fishy going on. But the fact that the Democratic Governors Association is spending something like $750,000 on negative ads against Larry Hogan, he says, makes, you know, two and two.
I see.
Equal five or something.
Yeah. Well, he's got to come back with something. He's launched some of his own campaign commercials. But Anthony Brown, let's see. Let's go over this a little bit. Anthony Brown, Lieutenant Governor of Maryland, some people say this is his campaign to lose, has launched, unleashed attack ads against Larry Hogan. And some of us who've been watching politics for quite a while think this is a little weird. Why so hard and so heavy so early?
Well, that's true. And it of course, it is his race to lose. This is a predominantly Democratic state. There is a strong record of the O'Malley Brown administration to run on, which he has been doing. So, you know, there, by all, if he just sort of plays nice and make sure he gets his folks to the polls, and they are their ground game. They're working very hard on the get out the vote effort. If just play nice, and he should be fine. But for some reason, he has decided to help with the help of this money from the Democratic Governors Association to really go negative. And one of the things they are attacking Hogan on is a position he took on abortion more than 30 years ago, and saying that, you know, if he gets in office, he's going to take away, you know, women's right to choose. And there's no way. Larry just keeps saying, no, that's not how I feel. It's settled law. I have no plans. No, that doesn't matter.
He said the ads keep going. He said it on this show, and his focus on this show, it was hard to get him to talk about social issues. He was really focused on taxes, reducing taxes, reducing the burden on companies that operate in Maryland. Those are the things that he hits on. So,
and in a way, he stepped on his own message today, because yesterday there was just some bad news out of the, you know, State Board of Estimates that our budget is running short, despite some cuts that had been made earlier. We just have not had the rebound in businesses and salaries and jobs and so forth that they had been counting on and projecting. So that helped make Hogan's case that, you know, the O'Malley Brown administration has been, you know, too taxing too much, spending too much, and driving business out of the state. That was what he was going to talk about today, and then this came along.
Comptroller Peter Franchot, Comptroller of Maryland, reporting yesterday that the state is facing a $405 million revenue shortfall over this year, the rest of this year, and next. And the Sun reports today, largely the result of sluggish job growth, as Karen said, stagnant incomes, and a weak housing market. Let me turn to Chris Conley here for a moment, getting back to the gubernatorial campaign between Lieutenant Governor Anthony Brown and Republican Larry Hogan. Where do they stand money-wise? You've been taking a hard look at politics and money in Maryland. In terms of campaign funds, where do these two campaigns stand today?
So the last official filing that we had was the end of August, right? And that showed Hogan, you know, with an incredible lead on Brown. He had $2.4 million in the bank. Brown had something like $760,000. Now, Hogan's sort of done all the fundraising he can for his campaign, because he's taking public financing. So he's limited in the amount that he can raise for his own campaign. Brown is not in that situation, and he is a, you know, prolific fundraiser, it seems like. He's got about, according to his people, about $3 million has been raised since the end of the primary in June. Okay. So he's building up that bank, you know.
Has Hogan gone as far as he can go?
Well, sort of, kind of, yes. So Hogan has raised as much as he can for his own campaign. Now, he's doing fundraisers for the Maryland GOP. So the party can raise money and spend it in support of his bid for governor. He's had some help from most recently Chris Christie, the New Jersey governor, came down and did a fundraiser for him, really for the Maryland GOP to support Hogan's run here.
And Karen, Anthony Brown gets to answer Chris Christie with Hillary Clinton, right?
And, you know, what an answer that is.
Yeah.
And he also had Bill Clinton in here. And Governor O'Malley, who, of course, has his own long-term objectives, we think, the dreams and schemes, he is coming to announce plans to spend a lot more time, as the election is not even 40 days away.
We should also add in here, Vice President Joe Biden came out to do a fundraiser
that's
as
right.
well. So it's a battle of potential 2016 presidential candidates,
yeah.
Right?
Hillary Clinton, I mentioned, because there's a fundraiser coming up, right, at a private home, I think, in Montgomery County somewhere.
Yeah, that's coming up, I believe, next week.
Yeah.
You don't get into those things cheap.
No. Karen, thanks very much.
Oh, you're welcome.
Karen Hostler, who contributes to WYPR's news coverage of the gubernatorial campaign, other elections in Maryland. Back to Chris Conley. Chris had a really good series last week of stories about campaign finance laws in Maryland, including one report about loopholes that allow companies, or limited liability companies, LLCs, to bypass donation limits in Maryland. According to your report, though, that loophole is going to close next year, right?
Yeah, the 2013 Campaign Finance Reform Act essentially is supposed to close this loophole. And the way it kind of works is you have these election laws that were made in the 70s, and in the 90s, the state legalized limited liability corporations, which a lot of like developers and real estate companies use to, you know, sort of limit the risk of investments, right? So I'm making a big strip mall somewhere. I would create an LLC to essentially run that project. That way, if that goes under, they find a, you know, toxic spill underneath the ground. You know, my whole company's not going to go bankrupt, just that LLC is. But because these LLCs sort of started coming around in the 90s and the campaign laws were written 20 years before that, they didn't include it. So the way that it works is they're not subject under current law to the limits that we have on corporate contributions in the state. Now, this 2013 law is supposed to close this down. The question, of course, is it enforceable?
So big company, Acme Company, sets up LLCs, and they can continue to donate beyond the limits that are in place for Acme, the big company, right?
Yeah, so right now, Acme can donate $4,000 to, you know, Anthony Brown or Larry Hogan, your pick.
Right.
And then Acme LLC 1 can donate $4,000, and Acme LLC 2 can donate $4,000, and Acme LLC 3 can donate $4,000.
Are the politicians in this state really going to close that loophole? Campaigns are becoming more and more expensive.
Well, they already have, and there are some teeth in the Campaign Finance Act. The State Board of Elections has a little bit more authority to fine violators. Basically, what they have to do is they have to prove that, you know, each LLC has about 80% shared ownership with the parent company, and in which case, all of those donations count towards the same
total.
Total.
Right. Hey, we mentioned Larry Hogan, who chose to go with public financing of his campaign. And one of your reports suggested that this may be the last time we see that. Why is that, Chris?
So this is basically the second time that we've seen.
I know it hasn't been used
public
much.
Finance.
Ellen Sauerbrey. Ellen
Sauerbrey
was a Republican candidate.
20 years ago, Ellen Sauerbrey in 1994 used it, and then it was dormant for about a decade and a half until 2010. When basically legislators looked at it and said, we're putting money into this fund and nobody's using it, so maybe we shouldn't. Now, the way that the money, this is why this may be the last time it ever gets used in the state. So the way that the money got into the fund was through voluntary, essentially checkboxes on your tax returns that say, I want to give X amount of money from my return to this Fair Campaign Finance Fund. And in 2010, legislatures said, listen, we don't see anybody putting any money in here, or we don't see anybody taking money out of the pot. Money's going into it. It's earmarked only for, you know, fair campaign type of things. So they removed the checkbox. They replaced it with a kidney research checkbox. So
is that right? I hadn't noticed that.
That's what I'm told.
Okay.
So basically, there's no more money coming into the fund.
No more money coming in. Larry Hogan's going to take a chunk out this year.
Larry Hogan has taken almost $3 million out. Heather Mazier also took about $750,000 out for her primary run.
Mm-hmm.
So we're down to about $1 million left in the fund, which is not enough to finance a gubernatorial campaign.
So the sun is going to set on this high-minded initiative that came out of the 70s or 80s. It's been a while since that's been in place.
It has, yeah. That was also part of that sort of post-Watergate. There were a lot of election reform laws put into effect. But there are proposals. I mean, there was a proposal last year, and there are set to be a proposal again this year to add the checkbox back in. There's a little bit of infighting between the groups who benefit from these checkboxes. So environmental groups last year were opposed to adding the public financing checkbox back on because that might take away from theirs.
Chris Connolly, I was glad to see you do these reports on campaign financing, money in politics in Maryland. And so you're keeping your eye on it. But who does actually keep an eye on this whole thing? Because that was the subject of your last report on this.
Yeah, and it's not very many people, I guess, is the best way to say it. In terms of nonprofit, sort of civil society groups, Common Cause Maryland is really sort of the only one, which is really one person, a woman named Jennifer Bevan Dangle, basically is their organization.
Yeah.
The State Board of Elections.
To see who's getting what from whom, right?
Exactly.
Basically.
Exactly. Right. And she's sort of the one tracking that, and also the one who's lobbying for sort of good governance efforts. the media has always played a role in this. You know, of course, it's worth noting that the media is shrinking. There's fewer people sort of in every newsroom watching these things.
Fewer eyes on the funds.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, the State Board of Elections plays a role here. And Jared DeMarinis, who runs the State Board of Elections Campaign Finance Division, pointed out, you know, basically he's acting as a referee for the campaigns to watch each other. And there's a sort of, you know, they're going to be paying attention to who's violating the laws or maybe violating the laws, and they're going to make complaints and so...
And try to make political hay.
And try to make political hay.
Larry
just to bring us all
Hogan
the way back to the beginning of the hour.
Thank you, Chris. Chris Connolly, who covers the State House and General Assembly for WYPR, now covering the Maryland political campaign, part of our news staff here at WYPR. Thank you, Chris.
Sure thing.
We have to take a break. When we come back, we'll talk about Maryland hospitals, what steps they're taking to prepare for infectious diseases, including... the Ebola virus. Is it inevitable that the Ebola virus will come to the U.S.? We'll ask Dr. John Smarr that question when he joins us after this short break. And welcome back, everyone. Dan Rodericks here. We turn now to the Ebola epidemic in Western Africa. Yesterday, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention put the total number of confirmed cases of the virus at 5,800, just over 5,800, and the number of deaths at just over 2,800. This is the largest Ebola outbreak in history and the first outbreak in West Africa. And the CDC predicts the crisis is going to get worse. They estimate at the CDC that the virus could potentially infect more than a million people in Liberia and Sierra Leone by the end of January. About 50% of people infected will die, says the CDC. Some think it will be higher than that. Joining us to talk about this again is Dr. John Smarr, Assistant Director in the Division of Infectious Diseases at Sinai Hospital in Baltimore, who joins us here from time to time on Midday for Midday on Health. John, nice to see you again.
Good to see you, Dan.
Hospitals are making sure that they would be able to treat patients with Ebola here in Maryland, here in the United States. My question, I guess, is what's the feeling about this, the feeling or the sense that Ebola in the United States is inevitable?
Well, it really depends on who you ask. And one of the things that comes up whenever you're thinking about this is the idea of, you know, they've put a lot of travel restrictions to these countries that are in such a bad way with regards to the Ebola cases. And what was really interesting, I don't know if you saw this, but a few days ago, the World Health Organization actually came out with a statement, and they were saying that they think that we should not be restricting so much travel to the countries. And it was interesting because I think the argument is that if we're restricting the travel, then you're impeding the ability of people who want to help and resources to come into those areas. And two, because it's such a big hit on the infrastructure. So we're talking about the economy, we're talking about the politics of the region, the relative stability of things, that maybe that's going to be an impact. But certainly if we start having more travel, just the way things are, there is the potential for this to make it to the United States. And it's hard to put a word to that, but I think reasonable is probably a word you could use. It's reasonably likely that especially if we lift some of the travel restrictions, someone may make it to the U.S. And so all hospitals pretty much everywhere in the U.S., and certainly all in Maryland and including Sinai, we have protocols to assess patients who are coming in, which include detailed histories of where you've recently been, if you've traveled, so that we can match that up. And if there is even the hint that there might be a possibility that you came from one of these areas and you have symptoms that could be suspicious for Ebola, that we're treating it like an Ebola case until proven otherwise.
It seems like the spread of Ebola accelerated even since you were here last time.
Yes.
In the last month.
Absolutely.
And the estimates shot up higher the number of people who could be infected.
Yeah. And I actually just checked on the numbers again right before I came in, and it's up to 6,200 that they're estimating is affected, and it's up to 2,900 that have died.
Fatalities?
Yeah, for fatalities. And like you had mentioned, it's very part of this is part of doing epidemiology or the science of figuring out how diseases spread, is if you know a lot about the factors, then you can make mathematical models to try to predict what's going to happen if things don't change. And so the two numbers that people are talking about, one is there's an estimation that maybe by November we could be seeing upwards of 20,000 cases. And what you had said earlier, the bigger one, the terrifying one, is that by January, one of their models suggests we could be up to 1.4 million people in Liberia and Sierra Leone by themselves that are affected, which is one-tenth of their population. The total population of those two countries is 10.3 million people.
And those are just two of the countries affected
in West Africa.
What are we leaving out? Liberia, Sierra Leone, and another country.
Right, and there's Ghana.
Ghana,
yes.
Thank you. Now, in terms of Maryland, I was surprised to see this story. I don't know why I was surprised. It just seemed like the prudent thing to do, or protocol, for hospitals to make sure that they're able to treat patients with Ebola here in Maryland. I mean, is that something hospitals do on their own? Does it come from a directive from the CDC? How does that happen?
That's actually a really good question. And the big thing is that at every hospital, you have a Department of Infection Prevention and Control, which works with infectious diseases folks like myself as providers. And one of the key things that their job is to do is to essentially surveil announcements by the CDC, state health departments, for hints of, are there outbreaks of new problematic infections like enterovirus, which I think we're about to talk about.
We'll talk about enterovirus in a moment.
But it's keeping those on the radar and then trying to think of, okay, what is the realistic possibility that we need to worry about this? And the rule of thumb is pretty much you plan ahead. And so, like I said, even though apart from the few patients with Ebola that we've flown into the U.S. on purpose, we haven't had a case here. But that means, however, that such a public health risk, if it were to show up and we didn't have a protocol in place, that for months back when I would say probably May or June, pretty much all hospitals everywhere had at least this on their radar of saying, we have to have a protocol for if a patient comes in, because we just can't at the last minute decide, oh, we need to be sure we're doing everything right. We want to make sure that from the very beginning people are being screened, we're taking all the precautions, and we're doing everything we can to make sure healthcare workers are safe too, because, you know, about 240 healthcare workers have been infected so far, and about half of those have died, about 120.
So part of this would be training staff to recognize symptoms. That would be part of it. Now, what about quarantine? Wouldn't that be, I mean, you work at a hospital, you work at Sinai Hospital, so part of the protocol would be a way to quarantine patients, correct?
Right. There are, we call them precautions, as it were, maybe a kinder, gentler word. But it's the type of things that we do to prevent someone, if they have an infection, from that infection to spreading to us and to other patients. So there are quarantine-style rooms, to use that word, in terms of keeping everything separate, in terms of airflow. But then these type of precautions, like we have standard precautions, which describes, you know, you have to wash your hands. If you're going to be exposed to anything that you can predict, you need to wear gloves when you're examining the patient. And then things like contact precautions, where you need a gown, droplet precautions, where you need a mask, and that's for things like influenza, where someone coughs and the droplets are going to maybe spray out a few feet from them, but they're not going to aerosolize and get in the air and go very far. Or airborne precautions, where you actually need to wear a special mask, for instance, for things like tuberculosis, which is notorious for easily aerosolizing, getting in the air, and being able to float a long distance from wherever someone is. So being educated, making sure the staff know what particular precautions to use. The other interesting thing, and this is a big deal, is that the concern about the healthcare workers who've been affected so far is that these people are in settings where they know what to do and they're doing everything right. But you're working for a very long time. It's very hot. It's very intensive work. And so we think that a lot of the healthcare workers have been infected because when they take off all of their contact precautions, like their gloves and things, they may not be regimented about doing it in the right order. And, you know, if you're sweating behind the mask, you take off the mask, you wipe your forehead. If you haven't done everything else right, you might be inadvertently exposing yourself even in a way like that.
Just by, say, with your bare forearm, arm wiping your forehead.
Right, exactly. And so that's a key piece, is to make sure that everyone is well aware of sort of the pattern or the checklist of how you're supposed to take everything off. Because if you take something off in the right order or the wrong order, and you have, say, Ebola containing fluid on say a glove or on your gown, if that jumps to your skin, obviously that's all it takes.
Most American hospital workers, nurses, doctors, other staff have no experience with anything like this?
Well, we all
What even comes close to something like this?
Right. Well, I think the easiest thing to say is that these type of all the stuff that I just talked about in terms of the types of precautions, we all learn these, and we all learn these and use them on a regular basis. But simultaneously, as with anything in this world, be it even doctors and hand washing, using the right precautions when you're dealing with someone with an infection, sometimes you get comfortable, sometimes you get a little sloppy. And if something is not very highly infectious, if someone does something wrong on occasion, it ends up not being a problem. But the issue with Ebola is that it's such potentially highly infectious in terms of how little of an exposure can cause you to have the infection, that being casual or maybe a little bit more sloppy with how you're doing these things, is that there's a margin for error there that's unacceptable in terms of keeping yourself and everyone else safe.
Any chance of Ebola becoming airborne? I know you just touched on this for a moment. You mentioned the tuberculosis, for instance.
Right.
Now, Jeff says he's been reading and listening to reports about Ebola and this argument about whether it could become airborne. So what do we know about that?
Right, that's actually that's another interesting question, and there have been some debates in some areas among medical professionals about, well, as far as we can tell, it hasn't yet in any sort of a meaningful way. And again, when we're talking about this becoming airborne, we're talking about if I, say, were to have Ebola and I were to cough and you were 20 feet away from me and never got any closer and never touched anything, what are the chances that it could actually make it on these tiny particles and be able to travel that longer distance? And the idea there is, could it then land on something, land on you? Could you breathe it in? And based on what we know about Ebola, we haven't seen that confirmed as a method of transmission. It seems very, very, we're very confident that that does not seem to be something that we've seen. And so therefore, because part of this has to do with the type of organism you're dealing with, we don't think that that's something that could easily happen with Ebola. Of course, you could think of like a science fiction type scenario, or hopefully never science reality, of say the virus mutates and then suddenly it can change into this other thing.
Yeah.
And at least within the realm of what we know about the Ebola virus and the viruses related to it, this does not seem to be a meaningful concern. So for instance, that's not something that's officially recommended in terms of how you would deal with a patient who has Ebola to protect yourself.
In terms of training and precautions.
Exactly.
So, John, getting back to what you told us about the World Health Organization and the statement they put out about their concern about travel becoming too restrictive so that people can't get into countries like Liberia, Sierra Leone. There's a story out of Liberia today in the New York Times. These are heartbreaking stories about people dying and also being isolated in these villages and infecting relatives and friends. What did you think about the WHO statement?
So it's almost dealing with a couple of different things. It was hard for me. When I read this WHO statement, there wasn't a lot of, it's sort of more of a typical reporting on this. And so there wasn't a lot of detailed rationale behind why they were saying this. And so I was very interested to see that. And I'm still looking to get, I'm interested to see what kind of opinions come out about that. But going back to the article you had mentioned, the bad thing, and this goes even to the estimates of people who could get Ebola, they mentioned the figure that right now we're estimating that only less than 20% of people who are diagnosed with Ebola are actually being taken care of in isolated medical facilities. So over 80% of people
are home.
Yeah. And so there's the easy potential to spread it to friends and loved ones. And again, using some of these mathematical models, they say that we really, to be able to start curbing this, we need to get that percentage of people who are being taken care of in isolation by people who are practiced in doing it right up to 70%. I don't know what exactly went into that number, but it's based on their estimates. And bottom line is that we are a long way from that being something that that's actually being done.
We'll turn the page here from Ebola to the enterovirus, another issue that we need to talk about with John Smarr. Maryland just had its first case confirmed here, this rare strain of a flu-like illness, Entero D68, I think it's called, right?
Yes, there's something like over 100 different types of enterovirus, and so we stop with the creative names and usually fall back on letters and numbers in terms of designations. And this, and most of the types of enterovirus that we know, typically sort of common cold or flu-like symptoms. There are many, many viruses that can give you symptoms like the cold or like the flu beyond, say, the influenza virus. This particular type of enterovirus, we first found out in terms of isolating it in the United States back in 1962, actually. But it's never, we've never seen it associated with any outbreaks. There was a couple of clusters of cases a few years ago in the 2009 to 2010 area, but nothing big until now. And it was recently that hospitals in Missouri and Illinois started seeing clusters of cases of kids coming in who were so sick with a respiratory illness that they needed to be on a ventilator. And whenever you see a spike in the number of those, that's not what you expect. Say that's why we track things like flu season when the flu virus is going around, and certainly we're not in flu season, then that's something that needs to be investigated. And so when the CDC went in and started testing samples to see was there a particular infection that was causing it, they came up with the fact that it's this enterovirus D68 that seems to be doing it. It's probably true. Now, right now, there are over 200 cases that we know for sure. They're in 32 states. Maryland is now one of those states, so go us. But the big issue, though, is that it's hard to say how many people actually have it. So, for instance, the CDC only recommends to do testing on people where it's if someone is unusually sick and shouldn't be otherwise. And for the most part, people who get this are probably going to get the much more mild symptoms that you would expect with the cold or the flu. You're not going to, if you get this, it's not automatic that you are going to be so sick that you need to be admitted in the hospital or go to the ICU. But the big population of people we're concerned about is young kids with asthma. And that's or other underlying medical problems, respiratory diseases, because then you're not able to fight off this infection as well as someone who otherwise is medically fine.
Hey, can you answer this one quickly? Question from Teresa on Ebola. If one contracts Ebola and survives, actually, I think we touched on this last time you were here, does the virus provide any protection against future transmission?
The two answers are, good question, in theory, possibly yes. Do we know for sure would that happen across everyone who gets it? We have no idea, because that's the type of thing that you would need to have experience with, seeing a lot of people go through this. And we're kind of going to get this experience now, because we have so many. Again, when we've had 6,000 people who have gotten it, 2,000 people unfortunately have died. So you're saying that it's, at this point, it's sort of 50 to 60% off the top of my head survival rate. So that's sort of a question that we don't have the answer yet. But the idea is that even though Ebola itself has things that it does to try to escape our immune system, it is possible for us to make antibodies to it. And so the people who live through it very likely are making antibodies, but we would need to do, say, a study to test the blood of all of these survivors to see, do you have specific antibodies that would take care of Ebola? And we don't have enough data to be able to say that for sure, or what percentage, or things like that.
Dr. John Smarr, on the staff of Sinai Hospital of Baltimore, a specialist in infectious diseases, is a contributor to Midday, Midday on Health. Nice to have you with us today. Thank you very much, John.
Thanks so much, Dan.
We'll take another break here on our show. When we come back, we'll turn the page to Steve Almond. Steve Almond, author and journalist. We'll talk to him about his book, Against Football, and why he thinks it's time for fans to take a hard look at the sport they love, that he's loved for 40 years but can't watch anymore. He'll explain why when we get back. And welcome back to Midday. Dan Rodericks here. Joining me now, author and journalist Steve Almond. Steve's book, Against Football, takes on America's sacred cow and makes an argument that it's tough for some people to hear, especially in an NFL city like Baltimore. Steve is a longtime football fan and argues that continuing to support the sport and ignoring its violence and exploitative nature make fans complicit in the NFL's greed. Not only is the sport inherently dangerous, carrying the risk of brain injury, but recent scandals have shed damaging light on the NFL culture and its hierarchy, as we know very well from the Ray Rice episode of late. Steve Ammann joining us now. He'll be in Baltimore this weekend at the Baltimore Book Festival, and the timing is, well, I'm glad to get you on the show, Steve. Thank you for joining us here.
Sure.
And my reference to timing is because of the Ray Rice story, the handling of his assault case by the NFL and by the Ravens, of course, has become a national news story. And I wonder that this just adds another layer to your argument against football.
Well, I'll tell you what's been fascinating for me. I mean, obviously, football is an aggressive game. It's beautiful, but it's also savage, and it selects for savagery. It really, players have to suppress their empathy to be effective at their jobs. They have to control and express their aggression. And I think for young men under a lot of pressure, it's hard for them to regulate that aggression. You know, the moment they step off the playing field, they don't suddenly become gentlemen role models. Life is more complicated than that. Obviously, the players need to be held to account, and whoever is enabling them, I think we should all be troubled by the fact that Ray Rice was not treated like most other people are treated who commit that crime by the legal system or by the NFL. But I think the larger issue for me that's obscured by the Ray Rice and Broglio and Adrian Peterson, these individual guys who commit acts of aggression off the field, is what we now know about the violence on the field. You know, at the same time that this news was breaking about Adrian Peterson, we were learning that the NFL, after years of not just denying the link between football and brain damage, but actually generating a bunch of junk science like the tobacco companies to try to obscure the connection between the players and playing this game and their eventual cognitive problems, they revealed in federal court that 30%, nearly a third, they expect nearly a third of NFL players are going to have cognitive problems, brain damage in essence, at a significantly younger age than the rest of the population. Morally, that strikes me as personally horrifying as somebody who started writing this book because I saw my mother suffer a brain injury and be, you know, in an acute dementia. And once you see that up close, it's terrifying. You can no longer look at it as an abstraction. But I think even legally and financially, I'm trying to imagine another business model where in 2014 it would be acceptable for the company to say, yeah, you know, 3 out of 10 of our players are going to wind up with brain damage at a significantly younger age than they would otherwise. That strikes me as something we should all be very troubled by, because it doesn't just apply to a couple of players or several players individually committing a crime off the field. It applies to all the players whose violence and savagery we consume as fans. There is no Ray Rice or Roger Goodell or Adrian Peterson without us as fans consuming the game.
What brought you to this? Was it that? Was it this? The stories about concussions and brain injury? What was your personal odyssey? You've been a fan a long time of football. You said 40 years.
Yeah, I mean, I think part of it was realizing, feeling an increasing sense, as I think a lot of fans are, of being complicit in something that was essentially corrupt. But I think walking into a hospital room and seeing my mom gone, you know, one of the fiercest intellects that I know of, an incredibly brilliant woman, powerful, and with such a sharp mind, and she literally didn't know where she was. She didn't know why she was there. She didn't always recognize me. You can't see that and not start to connect the two synapses that football is desperately trying, and maybe more broadly, American culture is desperately trying to keep separate, which is the pleasures that we enjoy and the moral costs of those pleasures. Suddenly, Junior Seau and Dave Durson, and Ray Easterling and the other players who, and Tony Dorsett, the guys who are, you know, either took their own lives or are struggling with chronic traumatic encephalopathy, this form of brain damage that football players get, they suddenly weren't an abstraction. And I had something to do with them morally. They were in the same state, essentially, that my mom was in. And when it becomes real like that, you can't put the genie back in the bottle. And then I started looking at football as a moral activity and started interrogating it, which was no fun at all, I promise you. I would rather have been sitting in front of the game watching my poor Oakland Raiders get trounced. But once you start doing that, you realize, holy moly, this, you know, the NFL is an engine of nihilistic greed, and what fuels it is our devotion to athletic heroism. I mean, there's a beautiful game that exists. Football, I think, is like an intricate form of art, but it is also true that it instills certain attitudes, and it has very real economic impacts. The people of Baltimore lured the Browns away. They were left in lurch by the Colts, and then they lured the Browns away by paying $220 million taxpayer money for that new stadium and then giving it rent-free to Art Modell so the Ravens could play for 30 seasons, with Modell keeping every cent from tickets, parking, naming rights, concessions, luxury boxes, the rest of it. I mean, this is Baltimore. $220 million, or $200 million actually, was what the taxpayers paid. That could be used for a lot of really essential stuff that I think we all agree is more important than having a great football team, such as schools and law enforcement and creating economic opportunity in economically vulnerable neighborhoods and infrastructure. So it's not just that football in and of itself has problems with particular players and so forth. There's a larger system, a kind of set of cultural priorities that I think are way out of whack.
Steve Almond, our guest, A-L-M-O-N-D, his book, Against Football, One Fan's Reluctant Manifesto. Steve will be in Baltimore this weekend at the Baltimore Book Festival down at the Inner Harbor. It's moved to the Inner Harbor this year because of renovations to the Washington Monument in Mount Vernon. I'll tell you more about that before we finish out here. But Steve, what about those who say football can be made safe? You can have better helmets. You can enforce the rules against the high hits, the head-on-head hits, the helmet-on-helmet hits.
Well, I'll tell you, as a fan for 40 years, I think every fan of a game that's as inherently as dangerous as football carries around a little suitcase, and it's full of rationalizations and excuses. And I'm not saying that as an accusation. I carried around that suitcase. And one of the first things you say is, oh, well, you know, the players are adults. They get paid a lot of money. They make their own choice. They incur the risk knowingly, so it's not our responsibility. In fact, what my book's trying to say is, I'm not interested in the decision the players are making. I get exactly why a 20-year-old guy who spent his whole life trying to be a great football player wants to play football no matter what. I'm asking, what about the decision to consume the game, to be one of the people who's paying that guy's salary and giving him the heroic status that we give football players? But the second thing out of the suitcase is the NFL will find a way to make it safe. And that, I'm sorry, that's just not true. There's basic stuff that you can't undo. You can't undo physics. Mass times acceleration is always going to equal force. The players are bigger and stronger than ever. They move faster than ever. And they collide at great speeds with great violence. You cannot actually change physiology. The brain is a soft organ that's in a hard shell. I don't care what you put on a player's helmet. If football is going to remain what it is fundamentally, which is a collision sport, then that brain is going to get jostled around. And it doesn't matter. You know, football doesn't have a concussion problem. It has a violence problem. The fact of the matter is that the medical research has finally caught up with the game. And we understand that it's not these big catastrophic hits that explain the dementia we're seeing. It's also, and more invisibly and inherently and dangerously, the accretion of subconcussive hits, the tiny little car accidents that happen inside a player's helmet every time he collides with another player. Those are invisible. They're impossible to track, and they're impossible to create rules that remove that from the game unless you fundamentally change the game and go to something like flag football or touch or something. There are modifications you can make, which I suggest at the end of my book. I say, create weight limits so the players are playing at a natural weight rather than bulking up. That just makes them, it's lower mass, so the collisions aren't as violent. Put sensors on the helmet so you see how many G's a particular player is absorbing and make sure that they get removed from the game when they hit a certain limit. That would cause the coaches to have to pull players out if their heads were getting jostled around too much. But you cannot change the basic physics and physiology of the game.
What has been the reaction? Your book was only published, last month, I think, right, Steve?
Yeah.
And I notice on your website you're kind of set up to receive hate mail. You welcome all kinds of comments from people. You know, there are hardcore fans who just don't want to hear any of this.
Yeah. Well, of course there are. And, you know, 100 years ago, and I was one of those hardcore fans. I mean, let's try to keep track of the irony. The first two or three chapters of this book, people are going to say, why are they calling this against football? This guy loves football. He thinks he calls it a work of art. You know, he's talking all about how devoted he was to the game. You know, so it's really more of a lamentation. And I do expect that some people who don't bother reading the book are going to be really angry. And I've gotten, you know, various nasty notes from people suggesting that I should be, you know, be beheaded and whatever else. I expected that I would be in for some of that. But I think people who read the book tend to be surprised because I'm not writing it from the point of view of some egghead who hates football. I'm more like a heartbroken fan who's going, this great pleasure in my life, this source of identity, of kind of tribal affiliation, of an ability to connect socially with my mostly male friends, I'm losing all of that. And, you know, I'm deciding to step away from something that I really love. And I think people recognize that paradigm in their own lives. We have to do this all the time, whether it's bacon or alcohol or tobacco. At a certain point, we have to recognize that something we really love that gives us a lot of pleasure is also bad for us.
And what about, you use the phrase exploitative and go into this quite a bit, the exploitative nature of us, particularly the NFL and college football as well.
Sure. Well, I mean, you have to think about the dream that we are selling. And this is the dream of success. And I hear this is another one of the excuses that I used to use, and I think a lot of football fans use. They'll say, you know, football's the only way out for a certain kind of kid. And there's this coded language we use in America. What we mean by a certain kind of kid is a poor kid, a kid from an economically vulnerable neighborhood, and oftentimes a kid of color. What we're really saying to that kid is basically this. We don't care about the content of your character. We don't care about your intellectual or moral development. But if you get really good, kid, at this one really violent, exciting game, you have a shot at transcending your circumstance, at rising up out of the background that you come from. We're not going to give you great schools and great teachers and great support for your working mothers and fathers. We're not going to do that stuff. But we will give you this one shot. It's kind of like a lottery ticket. If you get really good at football, at entertaining us on Saturdays and Sundays, you know, we'll give you a college education. We don't really care whether you get a degree that has expanded your mind. We want you to stay eligible on game day, and then maybe you'll make it to the NFL. I think that's fundamentally degrading. It has nothing to do with the content of these kids' character. But it's also true that only one out of 500 high school seniors ever makes the NFL. They stay there about 3.5-4 years. They're usually broke several years after they leave the league. It's a false dream. And the other 499 kids who didn't happen to be born with the talent and skills and temperament, whatever else it takes to be a great football player, have to somehow also survive. And America is doing itself a disservice if it thinks that football is the way out for certain kids is a real solution to the crisis of equality of opportunity in our most economically vulnerable neighborhoods. It's just not. It's a distraction.
Steve Allman is the author of Against Football, One Man's Reluctant Manifesto. Steve will be in Baltimore Saturday at the Baltimore Book Festival. I have you here at 6 p.m. at the Book Festival at the City Lit stage, Steve. Right? Thank you. Thank you very much for spending this time with us, and appreciate what you have to say here. It's a lot to think about. Thank you.
Thank you.
Steve Allman at the Baltimore Book Festival. We misspoke earlier when we identified Ghana as one of the countries affected by Ebola. It's Guinea. The outbreak began in Guinea in December 2013. It spread to Liberia, Sierra Leone, Nigeria, and Senegal. I thank one of our listeners for tweeting us that correction. Dan Rodericks here for our staff at Middays, thanking you for joining us again for the program today. We'll be back in 22 hours for another Midday Show, Midday Friday, coming up tomorrow at noon. So have a great afternoon. Thanks for tuning in. We'll see you soon.
Midday senior producer is Nikki Gamer. The associate producer, Michael Hemowitz. Our engineers are Matt Taka and Luke Spicknell. Our interns are Connor Graham and Marjorie Goodman. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcast and live streaming available at WIPR.org. Dan Roderick's column appears in the Baltimore Sun. This is WIPR, your NPR news station.